Welcome to the Crimson Threat. I'm John Behrens, pastor of Restoration Messianic Fellowship in the Boulder Longmont area of northern Colorado. Our website is crimsonthread.com. This study was recorded during our normal Tuesday evening Bible study. Enjoy the study. So we are now in everybody's favorite chapter of Daniel, which is Daniel chapter 9. And for all of you end times buffs, we will go through numbers from a couple, three perspectives. So chapter 9. In the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, by descent a Mede, who was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, perceived in the books the number of years that according to the word of the Lord to Jeremiah the prophet must pass before the end of the desolations of Jerusalem, namely 70 years. A couple of things. Ahasuerus is the king who was subject to the book of Esther. So that's him. As I read secular history right here, he appears to be out of sequence. I have no idea what to do with that. I'll just make that remark, because as I look at secular history, Ahasuerus seems to be farther down than 70 years. But it is what it is, and so do with that whatever you like. Basically, they have been 70 years out, and Daniel is reading the scriptures. He's reading the book of Jeremiah. He infers from that that the end of the desolation of Jerusalem will be in 70 years, which is coming up. Now, the passage in Jeremiah that he's talking about is in Jeremiah 25. It starts in verse 8, but I'm going to actually go down to verse 11. So Jeremiah 25:11, "This whole land shall become a ruin and a waste, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Then after 70 years are completed, I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, the land of the Chaldeans, for their iniquity, declares the Lord, making the land an everlasting waste." A couple of things going on here. The 70 years is the duration of the Babylonian Empire. The fact that the Hebrews are stuck there during the entire time of the Babylonian Empire also makes it 70 years. But the deal here is, if you look at history, the Babylonians were a regional backward place, rose up to an empire, took out the Assyrians, lasted 70 years, and then were themselves taken out by the Medes and the Persians. So what becomes really obvious is God just sort of picked this empire up out of nothing, whistled them up, sent them down to take care of his people, and then when that process was done, shut them down. I think it's way cool. So at this point, Daniel realizes that the time is coming when the prophecy is to be complete. In other words, it's 70 years. Now, there's two ways you can approach this. If you are a fatalist, you can say, 70 years is 70 years. I'll sit back on my blessed assurance and see what happens. Daniel doesn't do that. What Daniel does is he actively intervenes with prayer. And I will gently suggest that that is part of what makes prophecy happen. The Hebrew Bible is not fatalistic. Greek and Hebrew is different. I've said that forever. The Greeks invented tragedy. Hebrews have no such concept. Okay, everybody know what a tragedy is? A literary definition of a tragedy, not the common meaning of the word. A tragedy is something that basically is baked into you and you can do nothing about it. So the most famous one I think everybody knows about is Oedipus Rex. The sequence of events that happens to this guy, he has no control over. It's just baked in the cake and he has to live through it. That is very much not Hebrew. In the Hebrew understanding of things, you always have choices, you have free will. And so these prophecies that are in Scripture are not the same as your fate. In the Greek sense, they have the concept of fate. which is to say, this is going to happen to you because it is fated that it will happen to you. Destiny is another way to say it. The idea there is that you are a player in some cosmic play that's being orchestrated by God, and you really don't have a lot of control over anything. That's not Hebrew. Hebrew, it's, I am giving you this prophecy. If you don't change, this is what's going to happen. But if you do change, the prophecy evaporates. So Daniel, when faced with reading the scriptures and saying, okay, the part where they were supposed to repent didn't do that. So now we're in Babylon. So the next event on God's calendar here is we're rolling up on 70 years. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to get in there and I am going to start praying to make sure that the next step in the prophecy, which is the release, happens on schedule. It's very different from the Greek way of thinking. And quite candidly, it's also very different from the Christian way of thinking, because most Christians think like Greeks. So anyway, Daniel, chapter 9, verse 3. Then I turned my face to the Lord God, seeking him by prayer and pleas for mercy with fasting and sackcloth and ashes. I prayed to the Lord my God and made confession, saying, O Lord, the great and awesome God, who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments, we have sinned and done wrong and acted wickedly and rebelled, turning aside from your commandments and rules. We have not listened to your servants, the prophets, who spoke in your name to our kings, our princes, and our fathers, and to all the people of the land. Very typical of a biblical prayer. First off, saying to God that you know who he is. One of the things that I haven't talked about in a long time is there's lots of spirits out there. When you start praying, you want to make sure you're hooked up with the right one. So what I start, typically when I start praying is, you know, blessed art thou, O Lord my God, King of the universe. So I'm making real sure that I'm talking to the spirit that I want to be talking to. So Daniel does that, and he also begins a process of confessing not only his sins, but the sins of the nation of which he is a member. And you can look at that in a couple of ways. Way number one is Daniel is in fact a leader of his people. Second in command of the Babylonian Empire. And he is a leader among the people. So for him to say something like this is not equivalent to, but in the same spirit as, for example, the high priest of the Sanhedrin doing such a confession. Okay, he's not simply a ordinary garden variety, run-of-the-mill Jew. He is one of their leaders. And that's important, I think. Verse 7. To you, O Lord, belongs righteousness, but to us open shame, as at this day to the men of Judah, to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and to all Israel, those who are near and those who are far away, in all the lands to which you have driven them, because of the treachery that they committed against you. The other thing to notice here is as he is recounting the things that have happened, he is very, very clear that God has acted rightly and justly, and all of the stuff that fell upon Israel was deserved. In other words, he's not whining, saying, oh, this wasn't our fault. When did the whining happen? Going to, I think it's the Song of Moses, where he says, I'm going to put this song in position so that when all this stuff happens to you and you say, if God had been with us, none of this stuff would have happened to us. Remember that? Well, if you read Jeremiah, what the people of Israel are saying as the Babylonians are coming down to sand them off is, God, why aren't you helping us? You know, with a high nasal five-year-old whine. Daniel is not doing any of that. He is standing up or kneeling down or whatever position he's in. And he is saying, we're here because we deserve to be here. And we are here because you are just and you are keeping your covenant. Sniveling to God doesn't do any good, and Daniel doesn't try. Verse 8. To us, O Lord, belongs open shame, to our kings, to our princes, and to our fathers, because we have sinned against you. To the Lord our God belong mercy and forgiveness, for we have rebelled against him, and have not obeyed the voice of the Lord our God by walking in his laws which he set before us by his servants the prophets. All Israel has transgressed your law and turned aside, refusing to obey your voice. And the curse and oath that are written in the law of Moses, the servant of God, have been poured out upon us because we have sinned against him. He has confirmed his words, which he spoke against us and against our fathers who ruled us, by bringing upon us a great calamity. Notice that he's saying, you are faithful, you are just, you keep your covenant, you gave this warning to our forefathers, we didn't pay any attention, therefore, because you are faithful, because you are just, you did what you said you were going to do, and we are in Babylon. That's sort of the essence of the prayer here. Notice that there isn't any sniveling going on here. He has confirmed the words that you spoke against us and against our rulers who ruled us by bringing upon us a great calamity. For under the whole heaven there has not been done anything like what has been done against Jerusalem. As it is written in the law of Moses, all this calamity has come upon us, yet we have not entreated the favor of the Lord our God, turning from our iniquities and gaining insight by your truth. So again, if you read the Tokaka, which is Leviticus 23, where the whole thing about the chastisements that come upon Israel is they are intended to get their attention and get them to turn back. And what Daniel is saying is it didn't get our attention and we didn't turn back. And he's also saying, by the way, that the word of Moses is true, and your word is true. And in the biblical sense, you are a true God. Remember, in a biblical sense, truth is a property of objects and not words. So he is a true God, and because he is a true God, his words are true. 14. Therefore the Lord has kept ready the calamity that was brought upon us. For the Lord our God is righteous in all the works that he has done, and we have not obeyed his voice. By the way, notice the word that he's using here, calamity. Does anybody have catastrophe in his translation? Disaster, okay. Do you have disaster? Do not use the word disaster. What's disaster mean? Disaster. The stars are against you. The point is, the word disaster is an astrological term. It means that the stars are against you. In, you know, the sense of astrology. So when you want to say something bad has happened, calamity is a good word. Calamity is a good word. Disaster is not, because what you're doing is you are ascribing the mispositioning of the stars to what has happened to you. 15. And now, O Lord our God, who brought your people out of the land of Egypt with a mighty hand and have made a name for yourself, as at this day we have sinned, we have done wickedly. O Lord, according to all your righteous acts, let your anger and your wrath turn away from your city, Jerusalem, your holy hill, because of our sins and for the iniquities of our fathers. Jerusalem and your people have become a byword among all who are around us. So now, having identified who he's talking to, I'm talking to Yehovah, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the one who brought us out of Egypt. That God, that's the spirit I'm talking to. He has acknowledged that God is righteous. He has acknowledged that they are where they are because they deserve to be. Now he is turning and asking for mercy. Verse 17. Now therefore, O our God, listen to the prayer of your servant and to his pleas for mercy. And for your own sake, Lord, make your face to shine upon your sanctuary, which is desolate. And again, he is saying, we are asking for your mercy. The only thing here that's in your interest is to act for your own name's sake. In other words, you have put your name out there. You have made prophecies to the prophets. These things are coming to pass. So for the sake of the reputation of your name, I am asking that you act. Notice, he is asking that God act, even though there is a prophecy that says God will act. Still requires a man to get in there and pray. Verse 18, O my God, incline your ear and hear, open your eyes and see our desolations, and the city that is called by your name. For we do not present our pleas before you because of our righteousness, but because of your great mercy. O Lord, hear. O Lord, forgive. O Lord, pay attention and act. Delay not for your own sake, O my God, because your city and your people are called by your name. Remember, he started off and he says, God, we're here because of your covenant. You made a covenant with us and you said, we didn't follow it, this was going to happen. Okay, you acted according to your covenant, but we're still bound to you by covenant. And you've given us a prophecy. And since we're still bound to you by covenant and you've given us that prophecy, we ask that you would exercise mercy and that you would do what you said you're going to do. I'm getting to the part now where everybody wants to weigh in. Verse 20. While I was speaking and praying, confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel, and presenting my plea before the Lord my God for the holy hill of my God, while I was speaking in prayer, the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the first, came to me in swift flight at the time of the evening sacrifice. He made me understand, speaking with me and saying, O Daniel, I have now come to give you insight and understanding. At the beginning of your pleas for mercy, a word went out, and I have come to tell it to you, for you are greatly loved. Therefore, consider the word and understand the vision. As soon as Daniel took himself to prayer, Gabriel was dispatched, and we'll see later on that the next time Gabriel gets dispatched, he needs help getting there, and he's going to have to fight his way through the Prince of Persia with the help of Michael. This time, there was apparently no resistance because the prayer was answered immediately. And we'll talk about speed of answered prayer and all that kind of stuff when we get down to the second instance. It's more applicable there. So Gabriel gives him an understanding of the vision that he has had. What vision are we talking about that we are getting an answer to, since this chapter, which is a self-contained unit, because he says, this is the date and so forth that I was in prayer and this happened. And what came to me then is an answer or an understanding of the vision. And the question then becomes, what vision? He's had several visions of the ascendance of empires on the earth, four empires. And I will suggest to you that this is an answer to one of those. So we're talking about the empires that he has seen in previous visions. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar had the vision of the statue with the four metals. Then Daniel had the vision of the beast coming out of the sea. And then we had, you know, the little horn and all that kind of stuff. So I'm suggesting it's one of those visions that we're talking about. Verse 24. 70 weeks are decreed about your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to put an end to sin, and to atone for iniquity, to bring in after everlasting righteousness, to seal both vision and prophet, and to anoint a most holy place. All right. All of you who are in your Greek thinking mode will notice that those things have not happened, which is to say, there isn't everlasting righteousness, transgressions don't seem to be finished, and a sin does not seem to have had an end put to it. Now, I will tell you I have another interpretation of that, and I'll talk to you about that as we go along. But understand that this stuff we're going to go through next, with numbers and counting and dates and all that kind of stuff, is pure Greek. It's figured out by people who are thinking like Greeks, and I'm going to suggest to you that they may be right. I'm not saying they're wrong, but I also don't find it terribly persuasive. But I'm going to go through it because everybody has studied it, and there's been some good scholarship there. All right, 25. Know therefore and understand that from the going out of the word to restore and build Jerusalem to the coming of an anointed one, a prince, there shall be 7 weeks. Then for 62 weeks it shall be built again with squares and moat, but in a troubled time. And after the 62 weeks, an anointed one shall be cut off and shall have nothing. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Its end shall come with a flood, and to the end there shall be war. Desolations are decreed, and he shall make a strong covenant with many for 1 week, and for half of the week he shall put an end to sacrifice and offering, and on the wing of abomination shall come one who makes desolate until the decreed end is poured out on the desolator. I will give you two different interpretations, and we'll start with the classic one, which has been in vogue for over 100 years now, and that's the one by Sir Robert Anderson. Anderson, as most of you know, was a Brit. He was a polymath, a genius. He also was head of Scotland Yard and a Bible study and, you know, all sorts of things. Bright, bright guy. And so he's looking at this and he's trying to figure out, when do the weeks start and when do they end? And he can't figure it out. And then he goes to Revelation, where it talks about 42 months. The only way 42 months can equate to 1260 days, which is also in Revelation, is if you have 30-day months and 360-day years. So he says, aha! A prophetic year is 360 days. So if I figure this based on a 360-day year, then I can get somewhere interesting. And I'll show you how he does that. Now, this is not far-fetched, because at the beginning of the writing of the Bible, before, I want to say, 701 BC, the year appears to have been 360 days. Then we had the long day of Hezekiah, and every calendar in the world went from 360 days years to 365 day years. They did it different ways. Like the Jews, for example, have the intercalary month where when the barley isn't visible, they stick another month in there. The Romans add 5 1/4 days and we have a leap year. I mean, all the societies figured out some way to get the calendar to work, but they all did it at about the same time in history. So the idea that the original year that God set up for planet Earth was 360 days makes a lot of sense. I can understand that, and it's good reasoning. I'm not sure it's right, but it's reasonable. So let's go look at his calculations. This is Sir Robert Anderson's. There's three breaks in there. So you have 62, and you have 7. Or 7, then 62. He doesn't do anything about 7 and 62. He just goes straight to 69. Because there isn't anything under that scheme that falls at 7 weeks. So anyway, 69 years times 7 is 483. And what he's doing is 70 weeks, he's doing 69 weeks plus 1. So 70 is broken down in this scheme to 69 plus 1, which means that there are 483 years. If you multiply 483 years times 360 days, you get 173,880 days. He's saying that the start is Artaxerxes' command to Ezra. You need to know when to start. There were 4 decrees, or 3, depending on how you count, concerning Israel. The first one is in 538 BC, which was by Cyrus, and it released the captives and says, y'all can go home now. And Zerubbabel gets sent off to rebuild the temple, and that's in Ezra 1, 1 through 3. The next one in 517 is basically a confirmation of this one. In other words, things were getting crunchy in the land, and the people that were in there that were not Israelites were getting grumpy, and they were sending notes back to the Persian Empire saying, you don't want these people back in this land. So they went back and they looked at the decree and they confirmed it. The next one is in 457 BC, which is Artaxerxes, and that gives Ezra basically the authority to restart temple services and restart a society. Then in 445 BC is Artaxerxes to Nehemiah, and that specifically says rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. And you'll notice in Daniel chapter 9, it says rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, right? So Robert Anderson, God bless his soul, starts with Artaxerxes' command to rebuild the city under Nehemiah. And he says, that's the decree that has to do with building a wall, so that's our starting point. He then fast forwards 173,880 days, and by a conversion and so forth, he gets then to 24 AD. And what he says is 24 AD is when Yeshua began his public mission. Then 3.5 years later, we get to Passover. So he gets then, using that, to basically 32 AD, and from there he gets you to April 16th, which is when Passover was in 32 AD. Just arithmetic. Put your goat in and turn the crank. He is assuming 360-day years, coming up then with a number of days. He's then going back to the secular calendar, and with that number of days, he's calculating from the decree to Passover. So you have two calendars working here. That's his assumption. And as I say, this is sort of received wisdom in lots and lots of Christian circles. I will give you another thought. There's a guy by the name of David Regan who has another idea on it. And he says, first off, the first problem is in 32 AD, Passover would result in, I think it's a Friday crucifixion. And furthermore, he says there isn't any reason whatsoever to assume that Daniel is talking in 360-day years. Because at the time of Daniel, the calendar had already shifted. Everybody was used to 365-day years at that point. And so it's most reasonable to assume that these are just normal years, besides which I think I can do something with that 7 days that Anderson doesn't do anything with. And oh, by the way, Gabriel breaks this down into 7, 62, and 1. And Anderson doesn't do anything with that first 7. He lumps 7 and 62 together to make 69 and runs from there. Reagan says, huh, I think I can do something with that first 7 if I use 365-day years. The other thing we says, oh, we got to start from a different place. We can't start with the command to build the wall. What we want to do is start with the command that was given to Ezra. And he says, if you read Ezra, Ezra assumes that he has got authority to rebuild the city, to include walls. And Ezra does. But if you go to Ezra, Ezra says, as he's making a speech, you know, we're back, we need to set up laws, we need to set up, you know, rebuild everything. And then he sort of parenthetically mentioned walls in there. So he seems to be under the impression that he's got authority to rebuild the city as it was before, even though the decree did not specifically say walls. So with that, if we start with a command to Ezra, and that's 457 BC, and you go to 27 AD, there's your 483 years again. Furthermore, 457 to 408 is 49 years. So starting at 457 both times. So if we go 49 years, which is the first 7, 7 times 7 is 49, go to 49 years, it takes us to 408 BC, which is the 15th year of this guy Darius Nothus. However, Josephus mentions that as being the end of the Ezra building period. In other words, what this guy Regan is trying to do is say, that first 7 weeks is in there for some reason. I mean, the angel said it for a reason. So if we start at 457 BC, which is the command to Ezra, go for seven, that takes it to 408, which is the 15th year of this guy Darius, which Josephus seems to indicate was the end of the building period under Ezra. Then we go to 27 AD, which he says, instead of being the crucifixion, which is what Anderson said, is the beginning of Yeshua's ministry. And then 27 plus 3.5 takes you to 30.5. And if you look at when Passover fell in 31 AD, it's on a Wednesday. So that takes you to a Wednesday crucifixion. Now, everybody see all the gymnastics we've gone through here?
Sure.
I will gently suggest that I'm not putting anything very important on either one of them. It's interesting, it's entertaining, it's fun to think about, but these guys have basically used two completely different methods, and they have come up with two different results. And how do we know that there isn't a third one that's correct? And these are bright guys, okay? These are not dumb people, and they are people who care. And as near as I can tell, they're not trying to sell anybody three magic beans. They're honestly trying to figure this out. And again, I am not discouraging you guys from doing this. It's great indoor sport, no heavy lifting, and typically nobody gets hurt. Although I have been in churches where people do get hurt over this stuff. What I'm saying to you is this is not something we should hurt each other over. But what I'm saying is everybody is looking at this from a Greek perspective. Everybody is saying, aha, if we get this date and we figure out how long the years are and we figure out about leap years and we turn the crank, we're going to be able to confirm that Daniel is true because the events he predicted actually happened. That is the problem with attacking this from a Greek perspective. And we're out of time. We will continue this discussion next time. God willing. I'm just saying, the words say what they say. What they mean is a different question. Would somebody like to close in prayer?